I take it everyone is familiar with our speaker tonight. On behalf of the Harvard Law School Forum, I present to you the Chairman of the Board of Titan Sports Incorporated, Mr. Vincent K. McMahon.
Thank you very much. I now feel right at home. I thank you for that reception. It was much better than the reception I had at Oxford, but not quite as good as the one I had at Yale. There you go, exercising your First Amendment rights. Let me start by telling you a little bit more about myself. I've always had the inclination to speak my mind. And unfortunately, from a physical standpoint, was many times beaten about the head and face, as we say in our business, but as a child, it's something else again. Many times, because I just could not hold back. I had to say what was on my mind, even though I knew that I was going to have this beating. And you would think that after the number of beatings that I received as a child that, you know, I would learn, hey, look, you know, stop it. But I just couldn't. There was something inside me that it said, no, I have to say what's on my mind. But there is a price to pay for speaking out. And our Constitution guarantees us in the First Amendment rights that we all should fight for and enjoy and exercise. And certainly I do today. But even today, there is a price to pay for exercising those rights. In 1982, I had the opportunity to buy my dad's company and did, and went national with it. I thought, quite frankly, what was working in the Northeast could work on a national, indeed a global case, and it did. Titan Sports in the World Wrestling Federation became very successful. And with success comes scrutiny, naturally. And there's this one writer who still exists, unfortunately. His name is Phil Mushnick, and he writes for the New York Post. And about 10 years after we achieved this level of success in 1991, Mr. Mushnick began writing all sorts of things about me exercising, in essence, his First Amendment rights. But as a public figure, your rights begin to change a bit. First Amendment applies to you even though you are a public figure, but everyone can get away with a hell of a lot more than they can if you're a private citizen. So there's a different standard in terms of the protection, if you would, of First Amendment rights. So Mushnick, recognizing this and being in the tabloid business, began to write a number of things that were totally untrue, the most outlandish things that, quite frankly, I think have ever been written about anyone. While he was doing this, he was also working in conjunction with the federal government. Now, here's what the government, after all of this searching in our organization for something that was wrong, this is what the government charged me with after a two-year investigation. Conspiracy to defraud the Federal Drug Administration in the manufacture and distribution of steroids. Conspiracy to defraud by distribution without a prescription. Can anybody tell me what the hell that means? No one has ever been charged with this before. No American, no one in the world, and no one will ever again because the laws have changed. In essence, again, it was a way, some way, federal government came to me on many occasions, Mr. McMahon, you need to cop a plea. That's what you need to do. Otherwise, we're going to take you to trial. And again, because of me and my principles, I said, fuck off. So nonetheless, we are indicted, have to drop the charges in 93. 94, we go to trial because we did not want to plead guilty to anything because we were innocent on all charges. And finally, one charge makes it to the jury. After the trial was over, just before the verdict, the judge decides to rewrite what I was charged with. That happened. So he rewrote what I was charged with and then gave it to the jury. Jury came back and I was innocent. That's terrific. However, the year after that, along comes another individual, other than Mushnick, whom I don't have a great deal of respect for, by the name of Ted Turner. Good old billionaire Ted. Ted and I tried to do some business together in the mid-80s. And then after we're doing some business together, Ted said, "We have to change our deal." I said, "Oh, we do? I didn't know anything about that." He said, "Yeah, you know, you're just getting too damn successful and I need to own some of your company." "That's not our deal, Ted." "Yeah, I know, but we're going to change it. And, you know, I should own, as a matter of fact, I should own most of it." "No, Ted, you shouldn't own any of it. It's a private company. I'm third generation in it. And Stephanie and my son Shane and my daughter-in-law Marissa are fourth." "All right." "Fourth generation, so it's really not for sale." "The business nor Stephanie." So then Ted and I decided that we just don't get along. And then along about 95, Ted decides, he picks up the phone. "Hey, Vance, how you doing?" "Yeah, well, I want you to see Jack Petrick. I want him to come up there and talk to you because there's got to be some way we can work together because as of today, I'm in the wrestling business." "Congratulations, Ted. I'm in the entertainment business." So Ted comes after us, opens his checkbook. We lose a lot of talent. And there was really no way to compete with Turner and his checkbook. He began to disparage us on any number of occasions, which, okay, fine, I'm a public figure, you can do that, and certainly Ted, as everyone else, is entitled to their opinion. We then decide, you know, we need to fight back in some way. We need to let our audience know what's going on here, but we need to do it in some sort of an entertaining fashion. So what we did then was we made up a number of billionaire Ted skits. This was our way to let our audience know as entertainingly as we could what was, we thought, what was really going on. 2 years after the billionaire Ted vignettes aired, and because of, and 2 years later as well, we began to express our views of their product. And our views of their product, quite frankly, is that we think WCW sucks. Ted Turner is not our only nemesis. The organization known as Morality in Media, a gentleman by the name of Robert Peters, who claimed that this was the most vile thing he had ever seen on television. This spot, of course, aired during the Super Bowl. And also said something to the effect that it's neither sport nor entertainment, and in addition to that, that in essence, no one from the human species should really enjoy this form of entertainment. And to that, I have two words for Mr. Robert Peters. All That's exercising your First Amendment rights. I like that. I like that a lot. And now the fun begins, because here's where you guys get to lob in the grenades. Ask me anything you want to ask me about any subject matter. Step right up.
My question to you is the change of the face we've seen, the change of WWF in the last few years. It's pretty marked and significant. But how has that changed your performers, your wrestlers? What have they had to go through the last few years as they've changed being purely wrestlers and moving towards the much more graphic, the much more, outspoken mannerisms and whatnot? How has that changed the wrestlers, and how have you found their response and their reaction to the change?
They respond very well to success. And again, opening the creative envelope, we've always said that we were in the entertainment business. But we've been able to create this hybrid that is sometimes more talk show than action adventure, sometimes more cartoon than some other genre, a soap opera genre we may steal from that particular night. But there's nothing on television like it. It's a combination of everything that is successful on television, and we get to resolve, generally speaking, our conflicts and what have you, or begin them in terms of some form of physicality. As far as the performers are concerned, they greatly appreciate that. It's another outlet for them as a performer to be able to show the world their varied background. It's not just, you know, okay, I'm a meathead, you know, and I can take an ass kicking. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people in this world that can fill that bill, you know. But you need to broaden that out, and those who do have the talent to broaden out, we encourage that. And they do as well, so it's a great mix.
Your son just made a hostile attempt at your takeover. He slapped you on national television. Right. What are you going to do in response to regain control of the corporation?
As far as my son is concerned, I'm going to get that son of a bitch.
What percent of the wrestlers' catchphrases and dialogue do the writers actually write versus the wrestlers coming up with?
We encourage our performers to come up with as much as they possibly can. We help them in terms of, we do have writers, and we do help them, and we listen to a lot of street lingo and things of that nature. But a lot of the creative comes from the performer, because the performer feels so much better about delivering that, if in fact it comes from them.
One of the phenomena that's really taken off in the last few years on programming are the number of signs that people have in the audience.
Right.
And I'm curious to know what the policy of your company is with regard to the signs that the fans bring in, why that's your policy, and maybe how it compares to the policy of your competition.
From my background, as I made reference to even as a child, I really believe in freedom of expression, and I like to exercise it, and I encourage everyone else to exercise it. It is also, by the way, one of the techniques that makes something known as something interactive with fans, and that's one of our secrets as well, is that we're extremely interactive with our audience, and we allow them, and indeed not only allow, we encourage them to bring any sign that they want to. We're the originators of that, to be able to, hey, look, express your views. You know, we want you to do that. And our audience really does that. Now we don't have to ask them to do it. They know, again, participation and so forth with chants and signage and everything else. It's really cool. Our competition, however, again, they copy everything that we do. So from an expression standpoint, our competition, especially, you know, since fans will, you know, as the lawsuit says, we'll say WCW sucks. They quickly go out, grab the signs, tear them up, and no, you can't do this, and, you know, take that T-shirt off, and, you know, and try to indeed, no different than Ted Turner himself, though, tries to manage, if you would, what is said and what is expressed. And it's not management, it's censorship. That's what it is. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering what role USA played when you decided to go this more violent and more risque route. Were they the ultimate censors on what you could do? And a related question, Turner owns TNT and you don't own a cable channel. What limitations does that put on you?
Actually, in a boardroom meeting with Kay Koplowitz, who was running USA at the time, Kay began to berate the choice of and direction that we were going artistically, wanted to know, you know, where were the heroes and things of that nature. And I explained to her that that is something the public doesn't want at the moment. And then she said, well, then fine, if you don't give us, you know, the heroes and build another Hulk Hogan for me, then you're going to be off the air. So I didn't have a choice. I was going to be off the air for sure if I took her advice and her edict. I'd have been definitely off the air. So I decided to go another way and let her throw me off the air. But what happened was that Barry Diller bought USA, and she was one of the first people to go. Kay did not respect in any way the form of entertainment that gave her the highest rating on her network, looked down upon it. She didn't get it. And I'm just happy that all of you do. And I thank you very, very much for coming here tonight. I've enjoyed it, and I hope you have as well. Thanks.